It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A mother flees an abusive relationship with her 7-year-old son in tow, settling in a small western Pennsylvania community. A new normal is established. Then Christopher goes missing. When he emerges from the local woods 6 days later, seemingly unharmed, he begins talking to a new friend only he can communicate with. And that's when things start to get a lot more strange. That's the premise of filmmaker and author Stephen Chbosky's new novel, Imaginary Friend, the Pittsburgh native's first novel since 1999's The Perks of Being a Wallflower. Chbosky spoke with 90.5 WESA's Christopher Ayers.
It's been 20 years since your last novel. So what took you so long? You've been a bit busy, correct?
Yeah, I'm a very slow typist. No, I'm kidding. Yes, I've been busy. I dedicated most of my professional life and artistic life to movies and television. And when I wrote The Perks of Being a Wallflower and published it back in 99, I very sadly, in hindsight, considered it something of a fluke because I consider myself a, quote, movie guy, unquote. And when I made the movie, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, and directed that movie, I fell in love with actually books all over again. And so all the other things I've done, whether it's Wonder, Beauty and the Beast, and all the other things, I always wanted to get back to writing a book. And I'm so, so proud and happy that I have.
And so now you're back with Imaginary Friend. And it's a bit of a departure, I would say, substance-wise from your previous novel. Why this turn to literary horror? What drew you to that?
Well, I think for me, it wasn't so much a change as an evolution. When I was growing up in the South Hills, Upper St. Clair, I loved movies, and I loved my very first kind of literary hero was Stephen King. I loved his books. I loved The Stand. The Shining is terrifying. And so, you know, for me, Perks of Being a Wallflower came from my love of the coming-of-age novel, and there are many that I love and cite as influences. And then for the second one, you know, I could have written, I guess, something like a Perks, but I felt like I'd already done that, and I wanted to return to literary horror, which is something of a first love.
How did you come to this particular story? What was the genesis and the kernel of the idea?
So the genesis was, I remember being a kid, and I think we all remember this, where you lay down in the grass, or I guess a roof if you're a city kid, and you look up in the sky and you'd see the clouds. And, you'd say what the shapes were. Oh, that looks like a dog, a hammer, a face, whatnot. And my what if was, what if a little boy looked up in the clouds and realized that for the last 2 weeks, it was always the same face looking at him? And that was my what if. And then I thought about this moment. Like he's in front of his school and the last of the school buses go away and he looks up and he's all alone and suddenly there as big as the sky is the face. And Christopher says, "Hello, can you hear me?" And there's a thunderclap in the distance. And then he says, which could be a coincidence. So he says, "If you can hear me, blink your left eye." And the cloud slowly blinks and unblinks and then starts to float away. That was the genesis. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know what was behind the cloud. I didn't know if it was in his imagination or if it was real for Christopher, but I just had to know. And so little by little, bit by bit, when I wasn't doing movies or other things, I would follow the cloud. And here we are.
And so that's kind of how the story really takes off in the book, is Christopher's first interaction with the cloud and him following it to wherever it may lead him.
In this case, into the Mission Street woods, where Christopher goes missing for 6 days.
Tell us a little bit more about the central character, Christopher. He has learning challenges. How does that impact him? Because that's sort of a change from before he goes into the woods and then when he comes out of the woods. That's the first...
Yeah, this first indication that things are different, yes.
That things have changed,
Yes, for me, Christopher's, he's dyslexic and he has a lot of struggles with math. He's a really sweet kid, but he's not a very good student. And it's something that I related to. I was a very slow reader when I was younger and I had some challenges. And so it was very personal to me actually to write about it, even though it's in this kind of supernatural context. And I thought how interesting it would be to have a little boy go into the woods and get lost for 6 days and come back out. And he's taking a math quiz and he gets his first perfect. And then he realizes, wait a minute, I'm not switching my letters and I can read everything. And this power begins to come to him. First it's academic, and then it's the belief that maybe I understand what people are feeling. And he becomes an empath. It was quite fun to little by little, bit by bit, stoke the fires of this story.
Something I realized reading the book is that this story explores several family relationships, mother-son, brother-to-brother, and a specific feeling that's associated with those relationships. Specifically, you come back to this theme of guilt. You come back to this idea of Catholic guilt a lot, and actually it seems like Catholicism plays a deep part in the story.
I would say this, you know, to put it mildly or simply, you know, if you're asking about guilt, I was raised Catholic in Pittsburgh, and guilt was as common to my family as pierogies, you know. So it's just something I understand very well. And whether it's, you know, a son that feels like he's letting his mother down by struggling with school, or a mother that feels like she's letting her son down by getting in bad relationships and trying to turn it around, or I think in my most favorite context, the character of Mary Catherine, a Catholic girl who's a teenager who is literally so afraid of sinning and then dying before she's able to confess that she creates this elaborate plan to know if she's on the wrong path, and she makes a bargain with God. It was a very, very interesting character to me, and so yeah, it goes really deep. I feel like, you know, James Joyce in Dublin a little bit.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Christopher Ayer, speaking with Pittsburgh native and author Stephen Chbosky about his new novel, Imaginary Friend. Stephen, like The Perks of Being a Wallflower, Imaginary Friend returns to Pittsburgh in western Pennsylvania. This one is set in the fictional town of Mill Grove, but picking up on the context that you offer in it, you can sort of figure out that it's somewhere in between, you know, Pittsburgh and Washington, PA, off of Route 19 in the South Hills.
Yes, it's somewhere near there.
So did you have a specific place in mind when you created it? What did you want to get out of the place where it is set?
Well, you know, I grew up in Upper St. Clair, and I remember when I made The Perks of Being a Wallflower movie, and legally, we couldn't say Upper St. Clair for whatever reason. I forget why. It, you know, even though the township was very nice to us, so I created a fictional name called Mill Grove. And based on Mill Valley and Ocean Grove, where my wife is from in New Jersey. So it was Mill Grove. And I just thought it would be fun whenever I wrote about Western Pennsylvania that I would always set it in Mill Grove, the way that Stephen King set so many things in the fictional town of Derry, Maine. So yeah, Mill Grove is just my version of Derry. And what I wanted people to get from it is, you know, look, anybody from Western Pennsylvania or from any, either Pittsburgh downtown or the suburbs, it's, we all know the woods and we all know the deer. And there are so many other local references, whether it's King's or Sarah's Chocolate Pretzels or Permane Brothers and the Pittsburgh Steelers, the Fort Pitt Tunnel, up and down the line. It's just, I love writing about my hometown. I love writing about my past. And yeah, and also I want people to start buying a lot of Sarah's Chocolate Pretzels around the world.
Well, you know, much of this story is told from the perspective of children, often in pretty terrifying circumstances. And there's a long tradition of scary stories that involve children and conflict with malevolent forces, you know, from Hansel and Gretel to Something Wicked This Way Comes to Stephen King's It. So what can you do with a child narrator in turmoil facing terrifying circumstances that you couldn't have done otherwise?
Well, I think that for this particular story, nothing is, if you look at most of the greatest horror stories, certainly horror movies of the last 40, 50 years. Yeah, there are exceptions, but I go to The Exorcist, I go to The Shining, I go to The Sixth Sense, even The Ring, which you know, has its own merits. It's terrifying, that little girl. My God, I'll never forget her. And so there's something, nothing is quite as vulnerable as childhood and as a child. And since I write about young people and I direct movies about young people so much, it felt very comfortable for me. You know, with Perks of Being a Wallflower, the terror is high school, with Imaginary Friend, it may be the Mission Street Woods and other forces, but it felt very, very comfortable to me.
Well, does the title Imaginary Friend, does that in any way refer at all back to Perks, with Charlie, the narrator and protagonist in that novel, writes letters to, at least in the book, an unstated or unspecified recipient? Is there any connection between
Dear Friend and Imaginary Friend? Yeah. First of all, thank you for literally being the first person that made that connection. This is the first time I've ever been asked this question, and 100% it isn't intentional, because the idea in The Perks of Being a Wallflower, where Charlie writes out to this kind of unnamed friend and how desperately he, as a young man, needs that connection. And in this case, with Christopher, this lonely little boy who wanders into the woods and then starts to hear a voice that may or may not be real or imaginary. And so hence, I call it imaginary friend. They are direct compare. Yes, 100% planned. And it's a theme that fascinates me, because it's a question I have that I often ask. What's the difference between talking to yourself and praying? You know, and I don't know, it's a subject that fascinates me, how we all need to talk sometimes to something that's not even there. And it reminds me of a part of the book that I was very proud to write, where Kate Reese, the mom, is remembering her late husband and how he said this little joke. He said, what are the two types of people who see things that aren't there, Kate? And then the punchline was visionaries and psychopaths. And when I say things like, what's the difference between talking and praying, or mm-hmm. visionaries and psychopaths, or even just the foundation of art, this is a fictional story that if I did my job right, and I hope I did, feels very real to people. And so I love the idea of, you know, whether you're praying or you're talking or really any of these scenarios, that we can ask ourselves all the time, is this real or is it imaginary? Is the negative voice that says, you know, we all have experienced this, that says, oh, I'm not good enough, or I weigh too much, or I'm this or I'm that. Are those voices, is that you or is that something else? Whether that something else is something supernatural, or that something else is just something from your past that continues to haunt you. All these things, whether they're figurative or literal, ultimately what Imaginary Friend, my book, is about, is trying to put the reader, trying to ask that question so that I'm hoping that the reader will come to the answer that is most empowering to him or her.
Author, filmmaker, and native Pittsburgher Stephen Chbosky speaking with 90.5 WESA's Christopher Ayers. Chbosky returns to the area 7 p.m. Monday, October 7th at the Carnegie Library Lecture Hall in Oakland for a conversation about Imaginary Friend as part of Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures' New and Noted series. WESA is a sponsor of the event, and you can find links to it at our website, wesa.fm. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, scientists say climate change poses immense risks to the U.S. and other countries. Did the Democrats running for president have any new ideas on how to address it? For WESA's Good Question series, Katie Blackley explores the history of the Pennsylvania Turnpike and how it helped lay the foundation for what would become the federal interstate highway system. And the fight isn't over for activists hoping to hold an Erie Coke company accountable. Plus, the Real Q International Film Festival kicks off tonight. That and more when The Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
Singer-songwriter Woody Guthrie is perhaps one, if not the most significant figureheads of American folk music. The Oklahoma-born People's Bard was as well known for his political activism, scrawling "This machine kills fascists" across his guitar at the height of McCarthyism, as he was for his landmark American folk songs like "This Land Is Your Land."
This land is your land, and this land is my land.
On this day in 1967, Guthrie died due to complications of Huntington's disease. His legacy would live on, though, in the countless musicians inspired by his folk music, like Bob Dylan, Joe Strummer, and Bruce Springsteen. For The Confluence, I'm Kylie Kaczynski.
What are the 2020 Democrats saying about climate change, and how effective would their plans be to address it? This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier. Scientists say climate change poses immense risks to the U.S. and other countries. Do the Democrats running for president have any new ideas on how to deal with climate change? To answer this question, I spoke with Leah Stokes. She's an assistant professor of environmental politics at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Stokes read every climate plan from the Democratic candidates and watched the entire 7 hours of CNN's climate town hall last month. For our podcast, Trump on Earth, I spoke with her a few days after the town hall, and we talked about what she's learned about the Democratic field. How would you sort of describe this field from those with more cautious plans, less ambitious, to those with more ambitious plans?
What we know from peer-reviewed research is that we cannot build any new fossil fuel infrastructure and stay within a 1.5 degrees Celsius warming target. So if that's your goal, to stay within a 1.5 degrees Celsius warming target, it means that the positions of Joe Biden and Amy Klobuchar are not tenable, because they have continued to say that we will support natural gas infrastructure in the United States. And in defense of both of those candidates, I think they say that in good faith, that they say, look, this is the world we live in. We have natural gas. We can't just shut down the industry tomorrow. And that's true and fair. And Julian Castro fits a little bit in that camp too, although he, I think, is a bit more towards a phase out. But actually, if we want to have climate stability, we have to say that that is not a viable position. So then we have other candidates who are more willing to do the hard work of keeping fossil fuels in the ground. That's not going to be a simple thing to do. That's fundamentally about destroying assets of wealthy, powerful people in society. Many other candidates have plans that say that we're going to ban fracking. That's Bernie Sanders' position. Or we're going to phase it out. That's Elizabeth Warren's position. I will say one place of pretty much unanimous support, and it's great that this is a unanimous position, is they're going to end the leases of public lands for fossil fuel development.
How do you see these candidates in terms of their ability to communicate these policy goals? Who stuck out to you as, like, I can see people getting won over by them?
I think that Elizabeth Warren was the most positive, upbeat, high energy. She really presented this as an economic opportunity. And I've done some research that shows, for example, that emphasizing the benefits of acting, that can really bring more people along with the plan. That includes Republicans. I will also give credit to Bernie Sanders. You know, it's clear that he's very passionate about this subject, that he doesn't want big polluters to be able to continue with impunity. And even somebody like Andrew Yang, who I don't always agree with, you know, he brought a different flavor to the issue, and I think that was valuable. He was willing to talk about technologies like things like geoengineering that other people aren't willing to talk about or don't even really know about. And I think while that's a very dangerous and tricky topic, it is important that we be having these conversations in our democracy. And I think Andrew Yang has added that to the primary for sure.
Leah Stokes is an assistant professor of environmental politics at UC Santa Barbara. There's more of our conversation. Go to TrumpOnEarth.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pennsylvania Turnpike was once called the world's greatest highway. For our Good Question series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley looks at the origins of the 360-mile roadway.
Good Question asker Elaine Harold from Highland Park wondered about the markers on the Pennsylvania Turnpike.
Question on where they measure the mileage to Pittsburgh from. I mean, what is the point?
According to Turnpike officials, the point is here in Pittsburgh's Central Business District. But depending on the GPS system, it's either here in front of Mellon Green on the corner of Grant Street and 6th Avenue, or a block away in front of the City-County building on Grant Street. Some cities, like France, have a point zero marker, but Pittsburgh doesn't. Good Question's Janet Thompson from the North Side also asked about the Turnpike.
I wondered about the probability of the exit to Pittsburgh on the Turnpike actually being on mile 57.
The Pennsylvania Turnpike, the concrete connector of the Commonwealth and America's first superhighway. Carl DeFebo with the Turnpike knows a lot about the road's history and says while it is ironic that the number is the same as the famous 57 Heinz Company varieties, it's purely coincidental.
Milepost zero is the Ohio border, and milepost 359 is the New Jersey border.
There was no secret scheme to pair the exit number with the ketchup maker. Most of the Turnpike follows the route of the defunct South Pennsylvania Railroad. The line was imagined as a competitor to the powerful Pennsylvania Railroad, but never completed. DeFebo says in the late 1930s, cars were becoming more popular and Pennsylvanians wanted a faster way to get across the state.
What created the Turnpike was really this concept of building an all-weather highway through the mountains instead of Route 30, which would take you up over the mountains.
The trip from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia on Route 30 is almost 2 hours longer than it is on the Turnpike. Route 30, also known as the Lincoln Highway, stretches across the United States and opened in 1913. Six tunnels bored for the South Pennsylvania Railroad were used in the turnpike design. It was all-weather because it included standardized grades, so drivers didn't have to maneuver through steep mountains. DeFebo says before the turnpike, limited access toll roads were not common.
So it was designed by engineers who wanted to create a consistent experience from end to end.
Prior to the Pennsylvania Turnpike, streets were financed by the federal government or maintained by private landowners. The PA Turnpike was modern. The lanes were all the same width, and you could ride it without encountering a stop sign or a red light.
It laid the groundwork for today's interstate highway system.
Mitch Dockelman co-authored the book, The Pennsylvania Turnpike.
It was built to give employment to people for the Depression.
During the Great Depression, the federal government under President Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal created the Works Progress Administration. The agency provided jobs to struggling families, and the projects included bridges, museums, and hospitals. Dockelman says the original 160-mile turnpike from Carlisle to Irwin took 23 months to build.
There was a lot of hype about it when it was being built, and of course, when it opened, a lot of folks all over the country came to see it. It was an attraction, not only, you know, to get you from place to place, but it was just so new.
The turnpike had been built using right-of-way privileges for the railroad, often through rural areas and farmland. As a result, turnpike historian Neil Short says there weren't a lot of amenities for motorists.
The part of Pennsylvania traversed was really like the wilderness, and there weren't really roadside services along there. There was nowhere to get gasoline, food, or anywhere to stop and use a bathroom.
Service plazas were built at 30-mile intervals and included large sit-down restaurants and delis. Because there were no federal highway standards at the time, the turnpike's exits were numbered sequentially from 1 to 11. That changed in the early 2000s when the mile-based numbering took effect. Nowadays, the turnpike may feel like any other roadway, but its then-modern design and innovative approach to vehicular travel gives it a special place in American infrastructure history. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
Good Question is a regular feature on 90.5 WESA, where we investigate what you've always wondered about Pittsburgh. Check out more of our stories and submit a question of your own at WESA.fm. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Along the shore of Lake Erie, a plant takes coal and turns it into coke for steelmaking. But the facility has a long history of air quality violations, and state regulators have denied its permit to operate. The company appealed. Now, as Ed Mahan reports for State Impact Pennsylvania, a small group of activists wants the plant to either comply with environmental regulations or to be shut down for good.
Watch it, there's a railroad. Another one here.
Some of the wildflowers in this overgrown field reach Mike Campbell's head. We're walking through it to get a look at the coke plant. This operation holds special interest for Campbell, a college biology professor and activist.
During the fall and winter and early spring, you get a pretty good view of this part of the plant.
He can see a red smokestack and an area where workers bring coal.
We're getting a whiff of air pollution right now that I'll probably end up sending in a complaint. It smells like a mix of rotten eggs and fresh tar.
Campbell and other members of a group called Hold Erie Coke Accountable launched a public campaign to increase pressure on the plant and regulators over pollution problems. In July, the State Department of Environmental Protection moved to shut it down. But the fight isn't over. On a recent weekday morning, big trucks headed into and out of the plant as birds flew overhead. Trucks like this, as well as trains, bring in coal so it can be blended together and put in coke ovens.
Coke ovens are a really a tenuous kind of monster. You know, it's huge, it's hot.
That's Ed Nesselbeck, Environmental Director for Erie Coke.
We keep it at temperatures of about 2,000 degrees. We just use the heat to drive off the impurities that are found in the coal.
But that whole process results in emissions, including benzene. Exposure to benzene increases the risk of developing leukemia and other blood cell cancers. And state regulators say Erie Coke is allowing too many pollutants to enter the air. In May, the department said the plant had nearly 80 unresolved air violations over 2 years. That includes what the DEP calls visible emissions. The smoke was too thick.
We will take strong action around that.
DEP Secretary Patrick McDonald says the agency's decisions are about the law and science. But people can help it investigate problems by making complaints.
We're not going to be out there anywhere 24/7. So having people within communities aware and communicating with the department is absolutely essential.
Which brings us back to Mike Campbell and Hold Erie Coke Accountable. Campbell lives about a 10-15 minute drive from the Erie Coke plant. He often heads down to the waterfront near the plant for bird watching.
It's a biologically diverse site because of the lake and the peninsula being right over there.
Back in 2017, Campbell and others marched as part of a climate change rally. In a video posted to YouTube, dozens are taking part in a protest at a boat launch near Erie Coke. He's also concerned about the Trump administration's rollbacks of environmental regulations.
Me personally, you know, I felt like I can't control what's happening in Washington, but I can definitely get involved in my own community.
The DEP created a stakeholders group in late 2017 as part of a permit renewal process for Erie Coke. Campbell joined. So did Sister Pat Lupo, a Benedictine nun.
There weren't a whole lot of people from that neighborhood, and I think
after a few meetings, Lupo and others decided something different was needed.
That if we were going to really try to put any kind of pressure on DEP or Erie Coke, that we needed to have a group that was separate.
So Lupo and Campbell became leaders of Hold Erie Coke Accountable in August of 2018. Group members created a website and Facebook page. They raised about $15,000. They paid to create a video about the plant.
This particular area is actually a wonderful place for wildlife. If the environment was cleaner, it could be even better.
They worked with others, including Gary Horton, president of the Erie NAACP.
They don't let the issue go. It's not lost. It's not kicked under the rug.
A city council member said the group was influential. She introduced a resolution urging DEP to keep an eye on the plant. Campbell and others showed up to community meetings and hosted their own.
We clearly communicated to people what the procedure was for filing complaints right. with DEP when they observed or smelled something.
Now the plant's fate is uncertain. Erie Coke has disputed some of DEP's evidence, saying, for instance, that the department hasn't proven it is the source of smells that show up in complaints. But the plant says it has been working to make changes. Meanwhile, Hold Erie Coke Accountable says it is trying to gain more public support from leaders in the medical and business community. Sister Pat Lupo vows her group won't ease up on pressuring plant operators.
You know, even though at times it seems like, you know, right now we're kind of in a waiting period, we're not in a waiting period. We intend to, you know, still keep in ties with the people on our email list, to still continue to educate where we can and to still continue to move forward.
Back at the boat launch, the view includes Presque Isle State Park on Lake Erie. As your eye scans to the left, the red smokestack of Erie Coke looms. A judge recently ruled that the plant can stay open and keep on employing about 140 people until at least February if it meets certain conditions. DEP is contesting it. In the meantime, Campbell, Lupo, and their group will be watching for dark clouds or odd smells from the plant. Ed Mahan, State Impact Pennsylvania, Erie.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The 34th annual Real Q LGBT Film Festival gets underway this evening and continues through October 12th with 25 full-length features, 60 short films. TJ Murphy is executive director of the film festival. Welcome to The Confluence.
Hi, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
You bet. For those who've never experienced the festival, briefly tell us a bit about it. This is your first year as executive director.
Yeah, that's correct. The festival started in 1985.
It's just a kind of short, small, weekend-long thing. A few years later, we, you know, incorporated into a nonprofit, built our board of directors up, and every year since then, we've just grown.
Okay, so what do you love about it?
Well, that's a tough question. I would think, one, I mean, I think with every film festival, it's a sense of community, right? You know, it's not just going to see a movie. It's going to meet like-minded people, make new friends, you know, meet new people that you may want to date, which can be something that's really hard to do in the queer community, especially in Pittsburgh, when a lot of that scene revolves around bars.
Right. The length of the festival expanded this year, yes, from 3 days back to 10. Why lengthen it back up? A lot of films, not a lot of time.
Of films. I mean, I think it has a lot to do with the political climate today. There was just a plethora of fantastic films this year. I mean, we had over 60 submissions for feature length films and cut it down to 25.
Mm-hmm. You have a new home this year for the festival. Why the move from Harris Theater to the Row House Cinema in Lawrenceville?
Well, we had worked with Row House several times on smaller little one-off events and kind of just loved the feel and sense of community there. It's a really fantastic, intimate space. Lawrenceville is such a fantastic, vibrant neighborhood, and we really just felt at home. We feel right. that we share very similar missions with them.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the curation process. You mentioned lots of submissions this year, more to choose from. Real Q occurs later in the calendar year than similar festivals in other cities. Does that give you the opportunity to sort of scout out and assess the best of the other festivals?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I'll tell you a little bit. We have a volunteer-based screening committee that meets once a week. Throughout the year, we start meeting as early as January to prepare for October. It's all volunteer run. We're always looking for people. So if there's film enthusiasts out there that are interested in joining. So a little bit about what we do is we get film submissions from, every corner of the globe as early on as January of the year. And we send people out to festivals, whether it be San Francisco's, which is the largest LGBTQ film festival in the world. The Los Angeles Festival, the Toronto LGBTQ Film Festival, and it really gives us the upper hand to be able to scout those, really exciting and timely films out and see what those audiences are responding to and if they'll resonate with the Pittsburgh audience.
Our guest on The Confluence is TJ Murphy's executive director of the 34th annual Real Q LGBT Film Festival. The Real Q Film Festival obviously targeted towards the LGBT community, similar to how the J Film Festival brings in movies that celebrate Jewish culture. Pittsburgh has a few of these more narrowly targeted festivals, but no longer a big Pittsburgh Film Festival, if you would. Do you think we're lacking something by not having that citywide, all-inclusive festival?
Well, personally, I believe that there's always room for more film experiences, obviously, in Pittsburgh. So I would say that in some senses we are lacking that, broader appeal film festival that could reach out to a more general audience here in Pittsburgh. But the thing that I really love about those smaller festivals, whether it be J Films or the Japanese Film Festival, is that it really narrows down and gives people that sense of community that you might not feel in those broader festivals that are trying to reach all demographics.
What would it take to have such a big festival like that? What kind of space? What kind of other considerations, though?
Sure. I could only imagine. I mean, it takes us the entire year to prepare for Real Q, which is a 10-day festival in a single theater. And some of the other film festivals, whether it be like Seattle or Toronto, I mean, they're 3 weeks long. They're showing 200 or 300 films, bringing people in from all over the world. It would be a massive, massive project.
Let's talk about some of the films that you have brought in. Opening night of the festival is tonight, and you're starting with the winner of the Audience Award at the LA Outfest. It stars CMU grad Matt Bomer. Tell us a little bit about the film Papi Chulo.
Correct. So it's a really sensitively directed film by the director John Butler, who did a film that was an Audience Award winner for us a few years ago, Handsome Devil. And it's sort of a incredibly timely, unique buddy comedy of sorts
that deals very significantly with heartbreak. So I think that would resonate just, you know, with anyone in a really broad spectrum. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not necessarily a queer specific story or narrative that like several of our other films are.
The festival also features a youth series, including a documentary made by local teens about Lawrenceville's Blue Moon Bar. Tell us a little bit about how that film came about.
Yeah, so the Steeltown Entertainment Project reached out to us to let us know about their Real Teens series that they helped produce to just kind of help local teens express themselves through film. So we got in contact with the directors who are high school age. They sent us their film, and it's a really fun film in the sense that, you know, you're getting a perspective of maybe, you know, where I personally like to go out on most Friday, Saturday nights, the perspective of from teens that aren't even old enough to go there. So they,
the makers of this film couldn't even be served in the
right,
Blue Moon Bar.
Absolutely. And I think they interview a lot of the drag queens, and I think there's something to be said about, you know, there's a lot of excitement surrounding drag culture today. But it's not accessible to younger people, even though, you know, most of those shows are more than enough appropriate for them. So that's one film that we're showing as part of our Teen Dream series, which is this Saturday at 1 p.m. And actually right before that, we're going to be doing a drag queen story time co-hosted by White Whale Books. And that will also be at Row House at noon this Saturday, and we're really excited about that. That's open to the public, it's free, and that's even, you know, particularly what might interest people with young children.
International offerings as well. The Shiny Shrimps was produced in France. I understand it's based on a true story.
That's correct. One of the co-directors, it's kind of about his life in a French gay water polo team. It is a really, really fantastic film. It is probably like our most fun and heartfelt film that we're screening.
It actually created a bit of a hubbub about sports and homophobia.
Yeah, absolutely. It kind of creates a dialogue of the need to maybe have, well, the team is competing in the Gay World Olympics. And, you know, it kind of creates that conversation of why those things need to exist.
Mm-hmm. So. We have less than 2 minutes left. October means Halloween. You have a double feature selected for October 11th. What did you choose?
Yeah, briefly? This is one of my most exciting films I think we're showing. I am an avid horror fan. It is Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street. It's a very, very new documentary that deep dives into what many consider the first gay horror film ever created, Nightmare on Elm Street 2. Now, whether that was on purpose or not, I urge you to come see the documentary and kind of make your own opinions. But we're really excited after the film, the directors of the documentary and the star of Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Mark Patton, will be joining us at Row House for a Q&A after the film. And we will be doing a midnight screening then of Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
Sounds a little scary, though. Fun but scary?
Very fun. It's a very cheesy movie.
Okay. In just a sentence or two, TJ, of the ones we haven't mentioned so far, what's your can't miss film?
I would say it's a six-way tie between all the shorts programs.
That's a cheat.
Yeah, it is. We have just a wonderful, wonderful shorts lineup this year. There is something for everybody. We are touching on, you know, I would say several countries around the world, whether it be Iran, Japan, Russia. They're all fantastic.
All right. TJ Murphy is the executive director of the Real Q LGBT Film Festival, which begins tonight and runs through October 12th at the Row House Cinema in Lawrenceville. A note, WESA is a media sponsor of the event. TJ, thanks so much for coming
in. Thank you so much for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, nearly a year after the mass shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue, what does the community need to continue the healing process? The 1027 Healing Partnership opened its doors this week to serve those directly and indirectly affected by the tragedy. If you missed anything from today's program, like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, assistance from Christopher Stubbs. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, Hope you have a good day of good news.